Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the growing outrage against Trump's pardoning of Roger Stone, including the distinct possibility that the federal judge who sentenced him, Amy Berman Jackson, could challenge the commutation. Corey Brettschneider, a professor of political science at Brown University and a visiting professor of law at Fordham Law School and author of The Oath and the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents, joins us. We will discuss his article at The Atlantic, The Traditional Interpretation of Pardon Powers is Wrong. Properly understood, the commutation of Roger Stone's sentence is unconstitutional. Since the president's powers to grant pardons and reprieves is constrained by the limit in the Constitution, quote, except in cases of impeachment, Corey argues that the Constitution bans a president from using the pardon and reprieve power to commute the sentences of people directly associated with any impeachment charges. And since Trump's impeachment, which focused on Ukraine, included in the articles, quote, previous invitations of foreign interference in American elections and, quote, previous efforts to undermine United States government investigations into foreign interference in United States elections, there is ample evidence that Stone's guilt in colluding with WikiLeaks and the Russians and lying and covering up his activities for which he was convicted qualify as an exception to the president's pardon powers because of Stone's well-documented involvement in Trump's impeachment. Then, with the White House trashing and sliming the popular 50-year-long government servant Dr. Anthony Fauci, having sent out opposition research-type lists of lies and exaggerations against him, we will assess what role facts and science can play in explaining the worsening public health crisis we are facing now that Fauci has been gagged. Shannon Bennett, the Chief of Science and Dean of Science and Research Collections at the California Academy of Sciences, a virologist who has studied virus evolution, identification, and transmission, joins us. We will discuss the dangers of not just opening up the economy, but the schools, and how Trump is his own worst enemy because the only way to reopen the economy is to stop the spread of the virus. Then finally, with the owner of the NFL's Washington Redskins bowing to financial pressure from FedEx, which was threatening to take away their $45 million a year naming rights to the stadium, and Nike's and Amazon's removal of the team's merchandise from their online stores, we will speak with David Glass, a member of the White Earth Nation and the president of the National Coalition Against Racism in Sports and Media. He joins us to discuss this victory for Native Americans, along with the stopping of the Dakota Access Pipeline and the Supreme Court's decision to declare the eastern half of Oklahoma to be Native American land. And before we go to our first guest, I want to thank you, our listeners and supporters, who have donated to sustain and build Background Briefing as the radio station we broadcast from closes down and we transition to online broadcasting, particularly during this pandemic. Your donations will help us improve our recording capabilities from home, so we encourage you to throw us a lifeline and join the fact-based community of listeners we are building around the globe with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate, which helps keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to all those who are not in a position to contribute. And joining us now is Corey Brettschneider, who's a professor of political science at Brown University, where he teaches constitutional law and politics, as well as a visiting professor of law at Fordham Law School. He's the author of The Oath and the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents, and he has an article at The Atlantic, The Traditional Interpretation of the Pardon Power is Wrong. Properly understood, the commutation of Roger Stone's sentence is unconstitutional. Welcome to Background Briefing, Corey Brettschneider.
Thanks so much, Ian. Always a pleasure to talk with you, and especially at this urgent time.
Well, thanks for joining us. And as well as being unconstitutional, which we will certainly talk about, the commutation of Roger Stone was also unconscionable. And its genesis is pretty straightforward, that Roger Stone is a protege of Roy Cohn, who was Trump's lawyer and a mob lawyer as well. And when Roy Cohn was dying, he said, Donald Trump urinates ice water, and he handed off the Trump account to Roger Stone and also handed off the black book, the blackmail that he had on Trump. All of these lowlifes have insurance policies against ratting each other out. And Stone made it clear to Trump before he went to, he was about to go to jail on Tuesday. He made it clear to the Trump, you got to pardon me, otherwise I'll rat you out. And that's what Trump did. He pardoned him rather than have his so-called friend rat him out. That's the way I see it. I see this as just mob boss America.
And you know what? I think your beginning with the fact that it's unconscionable is actually the right way to think about both issues, both about the moral question here, the threat to democracy, and also the constitutional question, because I think when most people heard about this, they thought there's no way this can be legal. Of course, a judge is going to stop this. And you know what? When you had that, and my guess is this is all your listeners had that reaction, you were right. You should feel that this pardon wasn't just unconscionable, but illegal. And there are people, including Stone's lawyers and Trump's lawyers, who will tell you, oh, no, it's not unconstitutional. And we're going to get into why it is. But your instinct, the founders had the instinct. They worried about this case. They talked about a president who was going to try to pardon a co-conspirator in order to continue to get away with crime. They imagined it and they created mechanisms, they thought, in the Constitution to stop it. And the problem is that we've forgotten what they gave us. So that's what my piece is about.
And in addition to Trump, of course, the Attorney General, William Barr, said that Stone's sentencing was a righteous prosecution and the sentencing was fair. And of course, it was the DOJ prosecutors wanted 7 to 9 years. Barr interceded and reduced it down to 40 months. So what's Barr saying now? If he said it was a righteous prosecution and the sentencing was fair, what's Barr saying now?
You know, this is somebody, if he had any integrity, you know, when he was in the Bush administration or in law practice, he doesn't anymore. Because to stand by and let the president of the United States in plain daylight do what we know he's doing, which is to use the pardon power to help himself. It's a kind of self-pardon. You help me, I'll help you with this pardon. And that's what's going on and how an attorney general can try to not fight that. Now, there is this problem of the way that we've interpreted the power. Many people have talked about it traditionally as unlimited, that there, you know, the president can do whatever he wants when it comes to the power to pardon. And what I say is, no, the thing in there that people often notice that says, comma, except in cases of impeachment, was designed for the purpose that you and I are talking about right now. The way to understand that, and Madison made this clear, for instance, when he debated Mason at the Virginia Ratifying Convention, he basically said, no, you can't pardon a co-conspirator because of the impeachment power precludes it. Now, how that works differs from maybe the way that Madison saw it. He talked about presidents being suspended entirely by the House of Representatives. We're not saying that, but we are saying that the way to preserve the idea that this can't happen, that you can't be a traitor who punishes co-conspirators, is to read that except in cases of impeachment in a plain way, which is, look, if Stone's offenses are related to the impeachment charges, which they are, and I'll talk about that in a second, even though the impeachment focused on Ukraine and Stone was convicted of lying about Russia to Congress, that's enough to show that the impeachment power is lost when it comes to this issue. The connection, of course, is that this was an ongoing conspiracy to protect the president from any inquiry or punishment by Congress, including during the impeachment. And if he wouldn't get away with that, if he would have testified, we'd know about Trump's wrongdoing. It would have been part of the impeachment inquiry, not just Ukraine, but the ongoing collaboration with foreign governments to undermine our democracy. And that's why the founders created this mechanism, except in cases of impeachment. He cannot do it.
And again, I'm speaking with Corey Brettschneider, who's a professor of political science at Brown University, where he teaches constitutional law and politics, as well as a visiting professor of law at the Fordham Law School. He's the author of The Oath and the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents. And he has an article at The Atlantic, The Traditional Interpretation of the Pardon Power is Wrong. Properly understood, the commutation of Roger Stone's sentence is unconstitutional. So in your article, you explain that your argument is rooted in the Constitution and the text, history, values, and structure, that in addition to banning the prevention or undoing of an impeachment, the phrase also bans a president from using the pardon and reprieve power to commute the sentences of people directly associated with any impeachment charges against him. So is the key to this then, Corey, the take care part of the Constitution. In other words, the article emphasizes the limits of the president. It concludes with the duty of a president to take care that the laws be faithfully executed, and the caveat that he be subject to impeachment and removal for not doing so.
Yes, I think that the take care clause that you mentioned is part of it, but really the entire Constitution is designed around the idea of not allowing a president to serve himself in the way that we've talked about, not to be able to pardon himself or to pardon co-conspirators. So in addition to the obligation to take care that the laws are faithfully executed, think of the oath of office itself. You and I have talked at length, maybe you're sick of hearing about it, about my book, The Oath and the Office. And that's because the oath itself says that the president pledges to faithfully execute the office and to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. Those are obligations and limits as well. So the more you look at the document and the design of Article 2, which creates and limits the presidency, it's all about obeying the law, respecting the law. And what is this but the most lawless act? And so it's not a surprise that, you know, all these things hinge together, the history, the text, and also the structure.
So what are the chances, though? Trump is a political Houdini. He dodged the bullet with the Access Hollywood tape, with the Mueller report, with the impeachment itself. Can he dodge this bullet?
I'm worried. You know, he has, when you're so brazen, you mentioned Roy Cohn in the beginning, when you're so brazen to do something like this in broad daylight, his supporters think that he should be able to get away with it. And they're arguing on Twitter, basically, and elsewhere all over, that he can do whatever he wants. Now, I think we're at a crossroads. Is this Constitution enable a dictator to essentially do whatever he wants, or does it limit seriously his power? And what's my prediction? I don't know. He might get away with it, and that's a frightening thought. But certainly, at minimum, we have to fight back in the election to come. The House of Representatives, I think, should challenge this pardon by seeking standing. There's a judge now, the judge in the Stone case, is starting to look into what happened. I hope that something comes of that. If anybody, by the way, listening knows her co-clerks, please send my piece to them, because I'd like her to see the history and to see what power she has. This judge has the ability to say this pardon is unconstitutional.
Well, you're talking about Judge Amy Berman Jackson, and you know already Roger Stone tweeted out a sniper scope target on Amy Berman Jackson. I mean, it's unbelievable when you think about it.
Go ahead. I was going to say, Roger Stone, you know, this isn't just anyone that we're talking about. It really is. He is a nightmare of the founder's worst dreams. You know, somebody who's got no morality, no sense of obligation to the public good, and who is willing to team him up with an unbelievable narcissist to do his own bidding at the expense of the entire country and the world. And, you know, we've got to stop him. We've been too cavalier, too complacent in allowing this blatant corruption to happen before our eyes.
Well, I wouldn't count on Jerry Nadler. His bark is worse than his bite. You know, somebody I talked to recently said he talks loud and carries a little stick. What do you think?
He's my congressman, and so I'm going to hope for the best and, you know, say directly to him, Congressman Nadler, open investigations into this illegal, unconstitutional pardon. Consider impeachment if you don't get anywhere. Seek standing in before this judge in federal court to deny the pardon. And let's get legislation to make sure that this certainly never happens again.
And what about the impact of the op-ed in the Washington Post by Robert Mueller himself, who sentenced Roger Stone and who pointed out clearly in his op-ed that the guy is guilty and deserves to be in jail?
We were inspired by that in part. David Frum also has a piece in The Atlantic detailing that this was really, both of them show, an ongoing conspiracy, a deal. I'll pardon you in exchange for you. You keeping quiet. And that was all about impeachment. It was all about allowing this impeachment to be stopped. And that's what's so sad that Mr. Mueller, I'm glad he spoke out, but it's just I would like more. You know, he's really got to say that this can't stand. And he really needed to take a more active stand, frankly, during impeachment to bring this up and to say Stone's stonewalling has to be part of this, that the Russia investigation didn't yield nothing. You need an article of impeachment about Trump's obstruction of justice and obstruction of Congress in that area. And even if it wasn't a criminal offense, the undermining of the U.S. by allowing this collaboration, the negligence at least that he allowed this collaboration between Roger Stone and the Russian government and WikiLeaks.
So, Corey Bresnahan, what do you make of Senator Lindsey Graham, the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, saying that he wants Mueller to testify before his committee?
I think on the one hand, you know, I'd like to hear more, not less, from Mr. Mueller. And let's hope that his performance is better this time than it was during impeachment, when he really, you know, hedged and was unclear and incoherent. My skepticism, of course, is that Lindsey Graham is also part of this president's cabal. And, you know, has been helping him get away with it. And any hope, you know, certainly long past, that he was going to be a John McCain figure and stand up to this president is long gone. So we have to be suspicious of anything that involves Lindsey Graham, I think.
So you don't think he's finally going to realize that he can lose his Senate seat?
I think that is a real possibility. And he is craven. And so maybe... you know, there's hope that at some point his cravenness will intersect with his kissing up to Trump. But I watched a video or a Twitter description of him and talking about Trump and how he's a wonderful golfer. You know, I'm not seeing that turn yet. And, you know, I'm not expecting Susan Collins to do it or Graham. The Great Lincoln Project, you know, has an ad out called Names, where they say, remember their names, all of these people who are complicit. Certainly Lindsey Graham and Collins are on there. And no, I don't expect him to turn on Trump.
And Susan Collins said, after she voted against Trump's impeachment, she said, Trump has learned his lesson.
Yeah, she also thought that abortion rights are safe. And, you know, I find her... So she's among the worst, because I used to think maybe she's naive, but now I think, no, she's been duping all of us, you know, with just this naive act. And she is a good actor. But the idea that she's some sort of moderate is ridiculous. And we need to see her defeated in November, along, of course, with Lindsey Graham.
Well, just in the last few minutes, let's return to, you know, we mentioned Jerry Nadler should really have a hearing and do something about this. But what about Judge Amy Berman Jackson? If the law gives her the possibility of challenging this commutation of Roger Stone's sentence by President Trump, what's the mechanism there? And, you know, give us the best case scenario with Judge Amy Berman Jackson.
Well, I mean, you know, I would hope that she reads our piece and that she considers the question of whether or not all pardons are legal, and comes to the conclusion that they're not, and that there is a crime going on here, and that she's not going to be part of it. And, you know, I think she's got to stop it. That would be my ideal scenario. Is that likely? It would be a, you know, historic, epic thing to do. And, you know, I'm not a religious person, but I'll pray for it.
Well, let's follow it through, though. She does the right thing, and it's a tectonic ruling. It gets challenged by the White House, unsurprisingly, and it makes its way through the lower courts and ends up at the Supreme Court. I mean, that may take time, but how do you see it proceeding, assuming she does the right thing?
You know, that would be a victory for me, because I would love to have a Supreme Court argument about the question of whether or not an impeached president can pardon a co-conspirator. And the history is on our side. If these justices claim to care about the original understanding, that supports our position in the Atlantic piece. And if the justices have any integrity, I really do think that when they actually studied this the way that Jeffrey Toulis, my co-author, and I have, and if you read our piece in The Atlantic, you can go through the same reasoning that we would ask the justices to go through, and to look at the history, to look at the structure, to look at the values, and to look at the text. And our conclusion, as the title says, is the traditional interpretation of the pardon power is wrong. No, it's not unlimited. He can't pardon co-conspirators.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Corey Bresnahan.
My pleasure, Ian. Thanks for your show, and always a great experience to be in conversation with you. We're lucky to have you. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Corey Bretschneider, who's a professor of political science at Brown University, where he teaches constitutional law and politics, as well as a visiting professor of law at Fordham Law School. He's the author of The Oath and the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents. And he has an article at The Atlantic, The Traditional Interpretation of the Pardon Power is Wrong. Properly understood, the commutation of Roger Stone's sentence is unconstitutional. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back examining the White House's trashing and sliming of the popular 50-year-long government servant, Dr. Anthony Fauci. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Shannon Bennett, who's the Chief of Science and the Dean of Science and Research Collections at the California Academy of Sciences, who studies infectious diseases that can be transmitted from animals to humans. Previously, she was an associate professor at the Asia-Pacific Institute of Tropical Medicine and Infectious Diseases, part of the School of Medicine at the University of Hawaii, where she led a number of research projects on virus evolution, identification, and transmission with funding from the National Institutes of Health. Welcome to Background Briefing, Shannon Bennett.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us, Shannon. And since you've gotten funding from the National Institutes of Health, have you ever had any interactions with Anthony Fauci, the 79-year-old director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at the National Institute of Health?
Yeah, I interacted with him a few times. He gave a few keynote speeches over the years at various society meetings, and I respect his wisdom deeply and experience deeply.
Well, unfortunately, the White House doesn't appear to be respecting his wisdom and advice. There's actually a covert attempt underway, or it's even arguably overt. They've been sending out opposition research-style documents to the members of the press, trashing Fauci. Peter Navarro, the trade representative, is really on a kind of jihad against him. So what do you make of this effort to undermine, discredit, and slime this 50-year public servant who has served both Republican and Democratic presidents?
Well, I would say that there's a conflict of interest, unfortunately. If you are concerned mostly about the economy and you have your sights set very short term, then you may choose to make rash decisions in the face of science and health and the advice of someone like Anthony Fauci, and that will come at your peril. Ultimately, it will harm the economy if we don't react for the benefit of our health now, even if it's at the short-term expense of the economy. In the long term, we'll all recover better economically and health-wise.
But surely there is no way that you can reopen or revive the economy unless you stop the spread of coronavirus. That's what I find puzzling about this administration's response. If they want, as Donald Trump has said, I've created the greatest economy in the world, if you want to run on the greatest economy in the world that you have created, then your first priority surely should be to quickly contain this virus, because we have, centuries of history of how to contain pandemics through quarantines, and yet none of those steps have been taken in any meaningful way. It's just mind-boggling. How do you see it?
Well, not only do we have a long history of knowing what works to contain viruses, but every other country, well, many other countries in the world seem to be doing a better job of it than we are. And so we have existing evidence right now that wearing masks and social distancing and strategic quarantining and investment in contact tracing so that you can do strategic quarantining all work. And I don't really understand why the knowledge and science is being discredited so systematically by our government, but or at least at the federal level. I don't really understand it. I can't say any more than that.
Well, it may have something to do with the fact that apparently President Trump is galled by Dr. Fauci's high approval ratings. And a recent New York Times poll found that 76% of Americans trust Fauci for accurate information about the COVID-19 pandemic, compared to 26% who trust President Trump. So is that a possible explanation?
Well, it's certainly very good news, if you ask me. And yes, I would definitely say that there is a feeling that the administration feels threatened by science, and that's bad news.
But what can be done? I mean, it's not just the president himself, but he has this propaganda outfit known as Fox News that echoes his points of view, or in fact, inculcates a lot of these strange points of view in him, since he watches religiously Tucker Carlson and others who certainly don't have a scientific approach. So this problem seems to go beyond one individual. It's a constituency. And is there any way to get, as a scientist, is there any way for you to be able to tell people these are the facts and what you believe that you heard from Alex Jones or some other weird source simply are not true? I guess the real question is, do facts matter anymore?
Well, facts are extremely important, but if you are only listening to your information from certain channels, you might completely miss the facts. And so I think that at the end of the day, as more and more people have personal experiences with the impacts, the direct health impacts of COVID, maybe they'll start to broaden their consumption of information and hear the facts from different sources, from reliable sources, like Dr. Fauci. And unfortunately, I think more and more it's looking like more and more of us will have personal health experiences with COVID-19 because of the increasing number of cases that's running throughout the country.
And again, I'm speaking with Shannon Bennett, who is the Chief of Science and Dean of Science and Research Collections at the California Academy of Sciences, who studies infectious diseases that can be transmitted from animals to humans. Previously, she was an associate professor at the Asia Pacific Institute of Tropical Medicine and Infectious Diseases, part of the School of Medicine at the University of Hawaii, where she led a number of research projects on virus evolution, identification, and transmission with funding from the National Institutes of Health. So let's look at the broader picture then, with over 135,000 Americans dead. And most researchers think that is an undercount. It could be an undercount by a factor of, what, several hundred percent, which I find extraordinary. I don't know what the real figures would be, but you perhaps have some better idea of what the actual death count might be. But the infections are over 3 million. And as you mentioned earlier, other countries have managed to contain this virus, to practice social distancing and all of the other means that we have. We're all very familiar with them, and they've sort of nipped it in the bud. And incidentally, most of those countries are run by women. I don't know whether that's a factor, but...
possibly.
Well, what is your sense then of whether or not we simply you cannot put the toothpaste back in the tube. Has this thing gone on too long, been unaddressed, mishandled so chronically that we have missed our opportunity in this country?
Well, there are two things that would make me say yes to that. One is that with a reproductive ratio of well over at least three, that is a level of exponential growth that is really hard to contain unless you contain it early on, because every infection can lead to at least three or more other infections on average. And in some cases, many, many more. There are super spreader arenas like a crowded bar or a nursing home where the reproductive ratio of the virus is much higher. And so you might say that the train has left the station. The other challenge that I would say the answer might be yes because of is that I have not seen any evidence that culturally and socially we are really willing to do what it takes in this country
And that
to stop the
means
spread of this virus.
just doing all of the stuff that Dr. Fauci has been saying for months now. They're not exactly complex, and they've been repeated many, many times. Social distancing, wearing masks, washing hands, not getting into crowds, etc., and particularly indoor crowds. So as it spreads then across the South and the Sun Belt and into states that may have felt somewhat impervious while New York was suffering such chronic casualties early on, you think that perhaps there might be a change of heart?
Well, I would have said yes if it hadn't become so politicized. And now what I fear is that because not wearing a mask seems to be a vote of support for a deep state mindset that this is all a hoax, I'm afraid that even with the mounting reality of increased cases in people's own neighborhoods and social circles and friends and family, I'm worried that we still won't react fast enough to make the tough decisions.
Well, given Shannon Bennett, that the decisions appear to be taken, first of all, the discourse has been submerged into the morass of politics, divided and nasty politics at that. It does seem that the decisions that are being made by the White House are political ones, and more have nothing to do with the medical advice of people like Dr. Fauci, who's been effectively muzzled. The latest effort on the part of this administration appears to be really nakedly political. We know that all families with children are totally frustrated with having the kids at home and would love to have them go back to school, and the kids themselves want to go back to school. So we know that there's a lot of social pressure for kids to go back to school, but it does seem that the president is just simply pushing for, and along with the Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, pushing for kids to return to school as a political matter, not as a public health matter. How do you see it?
Yeah, I would completely agree with you that the pressure is coming and framed completely around economic recovery and not at all with a mindfulness to how to do it safely. And there's plenty of ways there could be energies directed towards delivering a hybrid model of education in the digital age with the appropriate social support that doesn't have to require a school to be strong-armed into opening simply because it will be good for the economy. And ultimately, if those parents get sick, they're not going to be going to work. So it's very short-sighted.
Well, we were discussing earlier that none of it makes any sense in terms of the president's priority of getting the economy back, because the only way to get the economy back is to first defeat the virus. And rather than defeat the virus, it's been absolutely given a break at every turn. It's not that the wrong decisions were made. More often than not, the exact opposite decisions to what was needed were made. So that's been the trajectory. But is there a way, though, to stop this idea of the kids going back to school, given that it is a probably cynical calculation on the part of the Trump administration that the public, you know, parents are frustrated and want the kids out of the house? And who's going to be the countervailing voice of sage advice here to stop this catastrophe in the making, which would be kids getting infected, teachers getting infected, and bringing home the infections to their parents and their grandparents in particular? With Fauci out of the way, who's going to do it?
I mean, I think that's a very, very important question that I don't know the answer to. As a parent, I'm going to vote with my feet and not send my child to school. And my school district is allowing those kinds of options. And at the state level, there's leadership at state in state governance that I would hope would be able to alleviate some of the federal pressure. But at the end of the day, I don't, this is going to have a huge impact on schools if the federal government is going to be punishing schools for putting their children and their families in harm's way and throwing fuel on the fire of this virus.
And is there any psychological diagnosis here of why people would be in denial about the obvious? And as more and more people are infected and hospitals are overwhelmed, particularly in the Sun Belt, that's happening now. Dr. Fauci himself said that we could have 100,000 cases per day, and it looks like we're heading into that. So I think
Yes.
there has to be some kind of, it's not just the president's cynicism and his only concern being re-election, but there has to be some explanation as to why the public, or at least a chunk of the public, perhaps as much as 30 or 40%, are buying into this. There must be some kind of sense of invincibility. I don't know what it is. Do you have any ideas? Just in closing, I know I'm thrashing about here, Shannon, but I'm.
Well, I do think that there is this sense that amongst some people that they feel invincible. That, you know, there was some information that young people may not be as impacted by the virus. A lot of that information has had new data added to it and is changing. That's the nature of science and scientific discovery. We always update our information with ongoing new data and better data, but I think that old, you know, the old the initial feelings that young people were somehow less susceptible or wouldn't get as bad an infection as older people led to some of that invincibility. And I think that there's also just a basic lack of understanding about how, you know, how viruses spread through populations. I heard a gentleman on the news say, "Well, if I haven't gotten it yet, I'm not likely to get it." That's not very logical because, of course, the probability of getting it tomorrow has nothing to do with whether you got it yesterday. And of course, with more and more people walking around with the virus, and furthermore, the data is suggesting that upwards of 50% or more of all transmissions are from asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic people. There's no way that anybody is invincible.
Well, Shannon Bennett, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Well, I appreciate it very much. And again, I've been speaking with Shannon Bennett, who's the Chief of Science and the Dean of Science and Research Collections at the California Academy of Sciences, who studies infectious diseases that can be transmitted from animals to humans. Previously, she was an Associate Professor in the Asia Pacific Institute of Tropical Medicine and Infectious Diseases, part of the School of Medicine at the University of Hawaii, where she led a number of research projects on virus evolution, identification, and transmission with funding from the National Institutes of Health. We're going to take a brief station break and back speaking with a Native American president of the National Coalition Against Racism in Sports and Media about the owner of the Washington Redskins bowing to financial pressure from FedEx, Nike, and Amazon to change the name of his team.
Longer to be free. I want
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is David Glass, who's a member of the White Earth Nation and the president of the National Coalition Against Racism in Sports and Media. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Glass.
And Rich, appreciate the invite.
Well, thanks for joining us, David, and I want to learn about the White Earth Nation, but let's just start out with a number of victories for Native Americans. The Supreme Court just recently ruled that huge part of eastern Oklahoma does in fact belong to Native Americans, going back to the Trail of Tears, and it was a surprise ruling written, the majority opinion written by Neil Gorsuch, who's one of Trump's appointees who joined the liberals on the court. And that's a massive victory. And then you've had the Dakota Pipeline victory as well. And now it looks as if you've got a victory that you have been pursuing, David, and that is a name change for the NFL team in Washington, D.C., the Washington Redskins. So how do you feel?
Well, you know, we welcome the name change. We welcome the name change. The National Coalition Against Racism in Sports and Media has been at the forefront in leading the efforts for over three decades. And, you know, I joined the National Coalition back in 1991. In 92, we protested the Washington team at the Minneapolis Stadium when they played the Buffalo Bills in the Super Bowl, cold day in end of January or beginning of February. I can't place the date, but it was cold. And we had a few supporters there, a couple hundred. And, you know, fast forward to 2014 when Washington played in Minneapolis against the Vikings. We had over 5,000 people join us. It was the largest sports protest rally in sports history. And it still stands today. Last year when Washington came back, it was a Thursday night game. It diminished our participation because of school night, and it happened right when people are getting out of work. So we had about 1,500, 2,000 people join us. But, you know, this is a good day. We'll give no credit to Dan Snyder for doing the right thing. He opted to do this because of the pressure being put on him by FedEx, Nike, PepsiCo, and this D.C. City Council and the mayor. So hats off to them. I think I know that they've been influenced by our participation in protesting the name and others, Oneida, the National Congress for American Indians, other organizations that have joined us over the years, both Native and non-Native, and the elected officials, over 200 of them. Who've signed up with us. So good day, and we welcome that change. We still have a lot of work to do, though, with regards to the Kansas City team, Cleveland baseball team, and Atlanta baseball team, and others in the college, high school, university era.
So you mentioned Dan Snyder, the owner of the Washington Redskins, or previously called the Washington Redskins. We don't know what the new name is, but he has been really implacably opposed to a name change. In fact, he told a reporter, "I will never change the name." And he asked, tell the reporter, and put never in caps. So he's been adamant. And so basically what you think happened here, David, was that it was more about money than conscience and decency?
The consciousness and decency belong to FedEx, Nike, PepsiCo, the minority shareholders, the Washington, D.C. City Council, the mayor of Washington, D.C., and all of the other individuals, the 5,000 people who joined us for a rally, the folks who continue to support us, Anti-Defamation League, National Congress for American Indians, and Oneida up in New York. And so many, many others who've joined us over three decades ago, and the folks who've gone before me, who've gone past to the spirit world, Vernon Delcourt, Floyd Red Crow Westerman, Charlene Peters, who's down in Santa Fe, Those folks who were at the very beginning of this organization and protesting the appropriation of American Indian names and imagery for their sports teams, whether at the high school, college, university, or professional sport levels, you know, those are the folks who have the who can say that they've been moved by the activism and the consciousness and such. And Dan Snyder only bowed to the pressure and the money.
And again, I'm speaking with David Glatz, who's a member of the White Earth Nation and the president of the National Coalition Against Racism in Sports and Media. So this struggle has been going on for 50 years, and you mentioned some of the pioneers on your side of the struggle, David. So the work that's yet to be done, I guess the Cleveland Indians, a Major League Baseball team, and the Atlanta Braves. And what was the third one that you mentioned?
The Atlanta team, Kansas City football team, the Cleveland baseball team. And then we have a number of high school, colleges, universities who continue to either have the Redskins names or a derivative of that. And, you know, there's a ton of them out there yet. We've been responsible for changing over 3,000 names of at the college, university, high school level over the past three decades. And, you know, Cleveland was the first one to in the pro sports to step forward with the retiring their character that they had for their logo 3 years ago, and last year was the first year that they stopped selling it in the souvenir at their stadium. So you know, hats off to Cleveland. Now they just have to find a new name, and Atlanta needs to do the same and outlaw the tomahawk chop and the paraphernalia that they sell. And Kansas City needs to look for a new name also. It's time to understand that these continue to be harmful and stereotyping our people, the American Indian community. And they need to wake up and join the world in 2020. I mean, the times they are changing, as Bob Dylan said so many years ago, but I think it's very appropriate for the period of time that we're in now.
Well, the Cleveland Indians have said that they're re-examining their name change, but given that Nike and Amazon, along with FedEx's pressure, but particularly Nike and Amazon, removed the Redskins team's merchandise from their online sales stores. So that seems to be a tactic that works, and I assume that that could be applied to the Cleveland Indians.
Yeah, we've written to Nike and asked them to take the same stance regarding Kansas City, Cleveland, and Atlanta, and we'll see what happens. I mean, Atlanta, when Atlanta played in the postseason play last year, and they got beat by the Cardinals pitcher Ryan Helsley, who's a Cherokee from the Cherokee Nation. The media swarmed him after the game and asked him, you know, how it felt to beat Atlanta. And he didn't talk about the win. He talked about how offended he was when the people were chanting in the stands with the tomahawk chop. And he said, you know, when he looked up in the stands and he saw all these people that looked like a little bunch of kids, and how offended he was. And then Atlanta did ban the tomahawk chop and the chant and the sales for the rest of the postseason play. But, you know, we were supposed to have somebody, they were supposed to have a gathering of folks over the winter, and I think COVID interrupted that. But we look forward to having that continued discussion with Atlanta to get rid of that and ban it. We'll see. We'll see what happens. So it's always been one step at a time for us, and we just put our heads down and our shoulders down and keep plowing through.
Well, it so far so good, at least with the Washington team. And it does seem that banning the sale of the merchandise is a pretty powerful tool. It certainly worked against Dan Snyder, who clearly was an obstruction. So tell me a little bit about the White Earth Nation.
The White Earth Nation is the largest Indian reservation in the state of Minnesota. We know ourselves as Anishinaabe. There's seven Ojibwe or Anishinaabe tribes in the state of Minnesota and four Lakota, Dakota, Nakota communities or tribes. And the White Earth is located up in northwestern Minnesota, not that far off of the Canadian border, maybe 100 miles, 125 miles. And we have over, we have approximately 23,000 enrolled members. What we have a gaming operation up there, which really is a jobs program, not only for the native community, but for the surrounding communities. And that's what tends to happen in rural America with these tribes, that they have gaming operations. They're basically jobs programs, but it's a good thing in that, you know, they provide some economic development, they provide jobs and earnings. And so the White Earth Nation does that. Currently, Michael Fairbanks is our our tribal chair. Go White Earth. It's been, you know, like all the tribes in the Turtle Island, which we know as the North American continent, we've been here from the very beginning. Prior to the Europeans getting here, you know, the indigenous peoples were here in the on this continent.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the victories, not just the one over the renaming of the Washington Redskins, but the extraordinary ruling from the Supreme Court last week declaring large parts of eastern Oklahoma to be Native American land. And the opinion that was written by Neil Gorsuch came something of a surprise. He joined the liberals in a 5-4 decision. But Gorsuch wrote, "On the far end of the Trail of Tears was a promise. Forced to leave their ancestral lands in Georgia and Alabama, the Creek Nation received assurances that their new lands in the West would be secure forever. Today, we are asked whether the land these treaties promised remain in Indian Native American reservations for purposes of federal criminal law. Because Congress has not said otherwise, we hold the government to its word." Now, we know over the decades and centuries, the government has broken its word. But this seems like the government's going to be forced to live by its word. How do you see it?
Well, we've had, you know, similar rulings. The Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe up here in Minnesota and the surrounding tribal entities won a case back in, early 1990s regarding harvesting of rice and fishing, et cetera, on the big body of water called Mille Lacs. And although it traveled from court to court to court, and the Mille Lacs Band and the Native Indian community kept winning, it kept getting pushed up to the next court, and finally the Supreme Court ruled, and that was the last court. So when they, when the scholars and the and folks who take a look at these treaties and these agreements, there's really only one way to interpret them, and that is that the United States government has given their word, and they need to honor that. Although over the years we know that the government has continued to break agreements and dishonor treaties, you know, this was Oklahoma decision was a surprise and a very, very welcome ruling for Indian country. And it's going to have huge implications as we move forward.
And what did you think of Gorsuch writing the majority opinion?
Well, he's an interesting character, isn't he? Because he's written on both sides in terms of, you know, sort of the liberal and the conservative causes. He's kind of gone both ways at different times. So, like I said, these are different times that we're experiencing in the year 2020. And we're going to come out of this on the other side of it a much better country. I think this movement that's happening right now with the Black Lives Matter and other in this underserved communities and the communities of color, along with the American Indian community, they're going to force this country to take a reckoning and take a look at the sordid and black past that we have and how we have treated, the different cultures as they have built up this great country. And we'll take a bite out of that racism and a bite out of bigotry. It won't be gone completely, but we're on our way to a more honest and forthcoming look at curriculum, I think, in the classrooms and how we treat and teach history.
Well, David Glass, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
And again, I've been speaking with David Glass, who's a member of the Wide Earth Nation and the president of the National Coalition Against Racism in Sports and Media. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. To help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate free, we have added a donate button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Lady dressed in white with a man she loved, standing along the side of the pickup truck. A shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right. Another headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared by half past nine. Became a cop.